nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So today we're going to continue then to talk about diffraction contrast imaging. And really, just as a reminder, so we catch the flow on things, and there's Jorge late. There's your exam, Jorge, okay? All right. So I just want to go through and remind everyone what we've been doing with this in the previous lecture so that we can continue down into some detail level stuff, right? We had been talking about for planar faults, for strain fields, how to modify the Howey-Wheelan equations so that we can understand the images that we see when we set up a two-beam condition. Again, the operative words being a two-beam condition where you choose a particular set of lattice planes, HKL, to have the diffraction occur off of. That's not good English. The idea then is that we want to understand if we have, in a perfect single crystal, we have this oscillation of the intensity between 0 and G as we go through the thickness, right? We want to understand how defects locally change that. In the course of doing the planar faults, right, we said that you have a single valued change between one section of the crystal to the other. And so as we look at a unit cell that's affected by that, you can take the regular lattice positions with respect to one unit cell, one portion of the crystal, and introduce some displacement function, which is, again, going to be single valued for a stacking fault. And then for dislocations, the idea is that we have discontinuous strain fields resulting from the perturbation to the lattice. And we reviewed what dislocations were, right? They were defects that sit within the solid. They're linear defects. They have different characters. They have screw. They have mixed characters. And the idea is, again, that these things are the medium by which plastic deformation occurs. So maybe the next slide to just use as a review is that based on what we learned is we learned that we can go through and put into the Howey-Wheelan equations. Here, this is the fourth slide or so. We can rewrite these things in terms of a different substitution of variables that lets us, again, discover the oscillations of intensity between the zero and the G beam and specifically couple in a continuous form of this displacement function. And then what we want to do is understand how, for a dislocation, that continuous displacement function looks and how we can use that to understand the images that we see. Again, what we're doing is basically locally changing around the defect core the relative oscillations of intensity between the zero and the G beam. Many ways to think about this. One way of thinking about it is that local to the core, you will have particular planes that are better oriented, that have a different S value to some extent than around the area away from the defect. And so you're going to have a different coupling because of the differences of the tilt local to the defect. One way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is that the defect actually acts as a medium that provides a different coupling between zero and G. So, you know, we saw when we looked at the Howey-Wheelan equations, we had this idea of an oscillating pendulum that was coupled, right, and there was some string tying those two together. So does this one oscillates, the other must oscillate at the same time. And so, and with a difference in the periodicity of it. And really a way to think about the defect is that it's changing the nature of the coupling, the string between the zero and the G locally. So if we're in a region that's perfect single crystal of fixed thickness, we're going to see a given amount of intensity in zero and G. But as you come and bring a column close to the defect, there's going to be a difference in the coupling between the zero and the G. And so at the exit of that column, you'll have a different relative intensity between the zero and the G beam. And so you end up seeing, again, differences in what the outcome looks if you select zero or G, because you'll have in different regions different relative couplings between the zero and the G as a result of this defect. Okay, so that's a way to think about it. I don't think I explained it that way last time, but maybe that helps. But again, what we want to do is try to understand this displacement function and how we can use that to analyze the parameters of interest for dislocations. Again, for a dislocation, the parameters of interest are the Burgers vector. That's the one that tells you the direction with which the slip occurs between one section of the crystal and the other. The other one is the slip plane. That tells you the plane along which that linear defect moves. The other one is also the line direction, which is just a vector along the length of that dislocation line. So if you know B and you know U and you know the slip plane, you have lots of knowledge about how things proceed upon the application of stress. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use the Howey-Wheelan equations, and we're going to take and use a description for the continuous variation of the strain field for a dislocation. So now we're turned down to around slide 10 or so. And basically, again, the idea is that if you have some dislocation that has a Berger's vector, right, it is going to be something that can be resolved into a screw component and an edge component. In other words, you can have any dislocation have some content that is pure edge, some content that is pure screw. And this equation here is the answer for an isotropic elasticity calculation for this sort of a setup of how this dislocation presents strain at some point at depth z into the crystal and at some distance x away from the center core of that. And so all this is here, this displacement function, is mapping out the amount of displacement from the perfect lattice positions that a given dislocation will provide at some distance away from its core. So again, as we look at this, if we go through an area that's far away from this dislocation, the zero and the G beam will be coupled by the Howey-Wheelan equations. They'll depend on the G that we've chosen, the lattice planes that are doing the diffracting. It'll depend on the S variable, because that's the one that provides the relative, it's the one that tells us how perfectly we're in the diffraction condition, and it controls the strength of the oscillation between zero and G. And then what happens is as we come into this defect, for each one of these columns, we're going to get different couplings between 0 and G depending on some parameters of the dislocation. And those parameters are the Berger's vector, the line direction, and the distance that we are from the core. And so when we look at the images of the dislocation, what we're seeing is essentially an integration over... I mean, you'd almost think about it as a pixel integration, right? Because we're looking at a 2D projection, and if I look down and I'm looking at my film, an area that's perfect single crystal, I've chosen the zero beam, I'm going to get some level of gray. And then if I have a defect that sits at a point, as I get close to that, eventually there's going to be some interaction between the dislocation in that column of material that causes a sufficient strain for there to be a different coupling between the zero and the G beam. And so we'll see some intensity diffracted out of the zero beam, and we'll see some black in that pixel that results from this continuous strain field. Okay? So then as we look at the dislocations, the black lines we see, they represent how that coupling is occurring. And again, lots of different ways to think about it. One way to think about it is that simply the dislocation core locally diffracts the electrons out of the zero beam or into the G beam. Or you can think about it in terms of the Howey-Wheelan equations and say that as you approach the core, you change the coupling between zero and G. Okay, so those are the two sorts of ways to think about it. And again, as we look at this displacement function, we see it's a complicated one, and we want to go through and understand the details for different types of dislocations. Okay. So that's, again, a review of what we talked about last time with maybe a different spin on it than I used last time. Okay? Any questions on that general idea? Steve? Okay. So the diagram we're showing is just showing here's the core. It has a Berger's vector associated with a dislocation. The line is coming out of the board. Okay, so geometrically, this is a slice. We have a dislocation line that's coming out of the board. And in this case, it's shown for, it looks like an edge dislocation because the B is perpendicular to the line direction. Okay, so that's just one, but it could be arbitrary B with respect to the U. Okay, and so what you're asking is what one is asking is that if I go some distance away from this in terms of both X and Z, what is the relative amount of displacement of that little increment of material? And then how does that relative little displacement go back into the Howey-Wheelan equations and affect the coupling of the beams between 0 and G at a given displacement? And then you actually integrate over the entire column to see how that turns out to give you a different intensity between 0 and G. Okay? As another way of saying that. And so computationally, what you do is you take this continuous R, you go back to the Howey-Wheelan equations, and you pop that in to the drdz, and you perform this rather complicated set of mathematics to find out, as you go down some thickness of z of the material relative to an extinction distance, what's the difference in the oscillations of intensity between the 0 and g for that column. And you do it pixel by pixel, and the simulation would then say, okay, here I'm far enough away from that dislocation core, based on the geometries, based on the u, the b, that I don't see anything. But as I get closer and closer, at some point the relative displacement causes there to be a change in this oscillation between the 0 and the g, and I see some black in my bright field image coming from that. Okay? And the calculations that you look at, it shows that you will not see a single pixel that is suddenly black, but rather it's a range of pixels around the dislocation core that fade gray into black because of the continuous nature of the dislocation contrast that you see. That also will tell you then that if you look at these images, and we can just pop through along here until we find a picture of a dislocation, is that you'll see, let's find just one of the really big ones. This is the one that I show a number of different, right here towards the end where it's dislocation interactions and tangles. You see these black lines, and they look relatively thin, but look at the scale on this. That's 1 micron, right? And so if you blow these things up, they have an image width to them, and they're not a single atomic layer thick in terms of their image. They present themselves as 10 nanometer to 15 nanometer black lines that have, if you do it carefully and you look, they'll have a variation of black to gray out to white that's continuous because of the continuous nature of the dislocation strain field that you're using. Okay? So that means that the resolution in a diffraction contrast image is on the order of several to 10 to 15 nanometers, depending on the details of what you're actually looking at. Okay? That means when you're buying a microscope, if you're buying one to do predominantly diffraction contrast work, the resolution isn't that big of a deal. Okay? So we're using a much older 2000FX downstairs that has a wide gap. It does not have a very high point-to-point resolution, but it doesn't matter. Right? It's got more than enough resolution to see these features that you're going to look at in diffraction contrast. Okay? Okay. All right. So, the thing that we need to do now is just to try to go through and again, understand how we use this and the geometry of this to then get some details out of it. And it turns out that as I was showing last time and kind of finishing up with, and I went a little too long on it, but the details are substantial in that this equation has some things that relate the edge component, the screw component vectorially with respect to the diffraction condition G. In the Howey-Wheelan equations, remember that extra phase term is the SZ plus G dot DRDZ, and so it's a G dot DRDZ, and so it's the dot product of that with the R that is giving you some particular differences in how the 0 and the g are coupled. What happens is that if we have a pure screw dislocation, a pure edge dislocation, a mixed dislocation, you're going to get different effects on the coupling between 0 and g depending on which planes you use to image because of the nature of the vectorial dot product of g dot R, which contains these vectors for the Burgers vector in them. Okay, so again, conceptually what that means is that if you want to characterize a particular dislocation, it has its own properties. It has a Burgers vector. It has a line direction. That's fixed for the thing that you're looking at. The thing that you can vary is you can vary the G, the set of planes that are used to image that dislocation. And what happens is particular angles that you look at that thing will give you different couplings between the 0 and the G beam, and thus different types of images. So that's the thing that we use to image these, is we say, okay, I've got this thing, it's a dislocation. I see it's got some direction, it must have some Burgers vector. What am I going to do to learn more about that? Well, what you're going to do is you're going to go through and use a variety of different angles, different G vectors, different HKL planes, all saying the same thing there, right? To look at that, and you're going to see, as I look down and diffract off of 110, does this particular dislocation show changes in the zero and the G coupling for that angle? If I instead look at 311, do I see particular differences in the coupling between the zero and the G beam? And so the systematic approach is then to go through and understand how the different angles that you look at that give different types of images. And it's all embedded again in the fact that G dot R is the determining factor for the strength of the coupling. Okay? So let's go through and look at that for screw, for edge, for mixed, and see how we use that to develop some criteria. Okay? So again, this is repetitive from last time, and I'm deliberately kind of saying this in a different way than I did last time, because sometimes different ways of hearing the same thing help you get them. Okay? Any questions on this at the moment? You know, we're only halfway through, so it should still feel not quite understood. But yeah, John.
When we image this, we're actually imaging the strain field caused by the dislocation.
Absolutely.
Not the same in every direction, so we see it there.
So John's absolutely hit on this, and I did say that very explicitly last time, and I was going to say it again here at a later point. But what John said is exactly 100% correct. What we are imaging is the strain field associated with a given dislocation. And the strain field looks different from different angles, right? Because the geometry of the crystal structure is fixed, right? It is an FCC material. The dislocation lies along 110 and has a Burgers vector of 1 over 6, 112. That's fixed. And that creates a strain in the lattice that has a particular shape, it has a particular magnitude, it has a particular directionality. And that's fixed. Okay? The thing that we do is we say, I want to look at it from one angle, from another angle, from another angle, from another angle, and see what I see by looking at that strain field. And it's the strain that causes there to be differences in how the zero and the G beam interact, and that's what we image, is the strain field. So that's, you know, this is called diffraction contrast imaging, but really it's strain field imaging in this case, okay? And that's different than the planar fault, right? The planar fault is a single value translation of the lattice, right? And that's not a strain field, okay? So when you're imaging dislocations, you're imaging the strain field that they cause in the lattice, and you see different things depending on how you look at that strain field. Along particular directions, that strain field will not be evident, okay? Because if you look at a given defect, it may or may not present a significant strain in one direction, right? And that's the key point that we're going to use to find out what the Burgers vector is, right? We're going to go through and say, all right, this dislocation has its strain field, and it's a three-dimensional thing, but it's not going to be large in some directions, right? Because, you know, if you put the pure edge in there, it's tensile here, it's compressive here, well, that means somewhere it's zero, right? Because it can't go from pure tension to pure compression without going to zero, okay? And so, again, what we're going to do is we're going to choose carefully what angles we look at this, and we're going to try to find one angle where we don't see anything, right? And vectorially, that's captured in G dot dr dz, okay? So it's the strain field that we image. Okay, did that help everyone, or did that confuse anyone? Okay, but that's it. It's the strain field. It's not as though, let's see how to say this carefully. There's a sense when you see these things at first, you see this black line, and I'm telling you it's a linear defect, that what you are imaging directly is a bunch of atoms that are in the wrong place. Right? That's a sense that you might have, but that's not what you're doing. You're instead looking at how the misplacement of those atoms causes a large field arrangement of all the atoms to be slightly off their correct position. Now, let's think about that differently. a dislocation does represent an extra half plane of atoms in some way, right? Or a twist of one lattice section to another. That's a screw dislocation. If you imaged it differently, let's pretend that we go through and look along the line direction, right? So that we're looking right along U, and then go to really high resolution where we allow the atomic level structure to be visible. That's high resolution stuff we'll talk about next. And you'll remember from the initial part of this class, I said that's because you have the zero beam and lots of Gs and you get different phase overlaps. Okay? Well, there what you see is you see an extra set of atoms terminate in a high resolution image. And you actually see the atomic level fault because of that. All right? And again, if you want, you can go through and image that, and again, you'll know crystallographically some things, and you can say, all right, well, there's this thing, you know, it's at an interface, for example, it's slipping along here, for example, its Burger's vector must be this. Or even you can go through and say, well, I can count my atoms, right, and find that my Burger's vector circuit is missing this direction, that must be at least the in-plane component of B, okay? That's the projection of B onto the plane that you're looking at. And again, for those of you all that aren't material scientists, you can ignore that, right? But that's another way to do this, okay? But in this case, the way that we're imaging is different. We're not taking the zero and lots of G and forming a phase contrast image. We're instead looking at the amplitude in zero and a single G as a way to do this, okay? Yes, sir.
So therefore, the follow-on is in a complex slip system.
So as a follow-on, if you are in a complex system that is not something as nice as FCC, you do whatever you can. You may, even as something like gallium nitride, right? So this is a fairly high symmetry material, wurtzite, right? It is difficult to find appropriate G.B conditions to analyze Burger's vectors in gallium nitride. And that's not so much because of the B, it's because of the U. Generally, you're looking at gallium nitride that's grown on sapphire, and what happens when you grow gallium nitride on sapphire is you nucleate little islands of gallium nitride that coalesce, and then this thing grows up as an oriented 0001 structure, and it's surrounded by essentially low-angle boundaries between the different crystallites that nucleated, and those low-angle boundaries express themselves as dislocations that point in the 0001 direction. So U is always 0001. And then, as we'll see, that means G dot B cross U. There's just no way to find a G in any of the orientations that a normal cross-sectional sample will yield to find out what B is. Okay, so even something as simple as that, it can be difficult. All right. So, and if you get into monoclinic or triclinic, Lord help you. Right? I mean, because the chances of G, and remember if you're doing, so that's the other thing too, right? Is remember if you're doing triclinic, right, then you can't, you know, what does G dot B? Well, you've got to go back and remember that now you're, right, G dot B is based on a right-handed 90 degree system, and your system is not that, right? You've got A and B and C not equal and alpha and beta and gamma not equal. So just simply doing the dot product is, you know, forgive the French, but it's a complete pain in the ass. You've got to go through and get a table and write yourself a Mathematica program, and it's just a complete pain in the neck, okay? So, sorry for those of you that do triclinic, okay? Yes?
Basically, you're looking for G dot B equals zero.
Right.
You have enough resolution to find out the relative intensity of the black or something.
Well, So you're asking about quantitative analysis of the contrast. Usually you don't go that far. One of the things is that now that we have cameras that are linear, right, a CCD camera is linear in its display of the intensity, you could possibly do that. I think I've seen an ultramicroscopy paper or two lately where people have tried to use some of those things to look at that. You know, with the higher coherence of a field emission source and the linear nature of a CCD, you can begin to go down that path if you'd like. But really, it's more of a I see it or I don't that's generally used as a way to look at this. Okay.
So
basically, if you're lucky, G dot B is enough, or G dot B cross U is enough, or you can use G dot B times S, as I'll explain, to give some intimation on things. Okay, so, but again, it's complicated. So There's a simple answer, which is G dot B equals zero, then you're looking down the strain field just the right way that you don't see it, and the dislocation doesn't appear. Okay?
So,
it's, yeah, even, yeah, so again, that's, we'll get there. Okay, so let's go through and do that in terms of looking at this so that we can start to go through these details. So that's the big picture. Let's do the detailed picture. And then once you see the detailed picture, hopefully the big picture will make more sense too. Okay? All right. So let's go through and go back and look at this, right? Here's my R where I have the full expression for my Burgers vector. This is just the edge component. That's the full Burgers vector across the line direction. There's always this LNR term that's associated with the size of the region of the core that cannot be determined by elasticity theory. This is all out of dislocation theory analyses, okay? So let's just go through and consider one type of dislocation, the pure screw. That's the one where the line direction U and the Burgers vector are in the same direction, okay? When that happens, B cross U will equal zero, and this thing gets a lot easier as a displacement function. And so again, we look at this, it's proportional to the Burgers vector, and so G dot R is proportional to G dot B, and so the contrast you see is directly related to the G dot B product. Okay, so let's go through, and what one does is takes and makes a table, and this is just, you know, again, going through and calculating what G dot B equals, right? And again, I have a Mathematica program that just sits in my hard drive, and whenever I need to do this, I open it up and just pop these things out, okay? So here's G dot B, here's a table, and you end up saying, okay, this dot with that gives me plus or minus a third, the third coming from the 1/6 in front of here, and then sometimes you see zero, and that's the key, is that in some cases, G dot B equals zero, and so that means that you will be looking down the strain field in such a way that it does not modify the coupling between zero and G. Going back to the second slide here, where we look at the Howey wheel and equations, what that means, third slide, is that this term here is zero, and so this here between zero and G and zero, this term is not affecting anything, and this is really just a return to the standard Howey wheel and equations. If you wanted, you could go back and prove that as this term goes to zero, this recovers the same form of the Howey wheel and equations. In other words, the coupling between the zero and the G beam isn't different, and we don't see anything for those dislocations looking down that particular set of HKL planes, okay? And so what that means is you go through, and the experiment is to basically go through and set up one of these tables and look and say, okay, you know I'm in FCC. These are some of the types of dislocations that I might see. You know that from a crystallography book, a dislocation theory book for your type of material, okay? In the case of hexagonals, it's 112 bar O's, 101 bar 1's, I think, and 0001's, or I think, or, no, that's not right. It's 112 bar O's, 0001's, and 112 bar 3's. You know, so it's just some number, you know, there's just answers for your type of crystallography, and you do this G dot B table. In some cases, you get zeros, and you're in good shape, okay? That's the thing that you hope. And so what you do then as an experiment is you then go through and basically create a bunch of images with different G. And so here's one picture, another picture, and another picture, where again, we've chosen to orient the crystal in different ways. The fact that this is oriented differently is apparent. Let's look at B, for example. You see that this is one dislocation line and another, and you see that as we tilt the sample, it shows up more or less as three different, you can't even see here, it just looks like two different ones that are intersecting. But at a tilt, you can see that these two guys are probably on the same slip plane, and they're interacting with that one there. And here we go in B, and we see these two guys, but actually the third one is now gone. I missed that the other day. And so what that means is that this one of the three is a different Burgers vector than these two because it is not apparent in the third image. Okay, so G dot B equals zero for that bottom dislocation here. Again, in E, we see it here, but not here and not here. It's kind of barely visible there. Right, so that's one of these things that's probably equal to 1/3, okay, as I'll talk about. So it's not visible here clearly and kind of visible there. And again, we go back to our table and we say that that might be, you know, a 1/6, 1/2 bar 1 if we knew that that was the G and that was the G and that was the G that we used, okay? So that's the way that one goes about and does this, is you take a series of images at different orientations, you see what you see, and that tells you, based on whether or not the dislocation is visible or not, what the Burgers vector must be. Okay? And that is the simplest one that you will see. This is, again, aluminum, which is isotropic. It's FCC. It works. Okay? The problem that you have is that we don't just look at aluminum. And so things get more complicated as you go to different types of material systems and different types of Burgers vector line direction combinations. If you go beyond having simple types of systems, then you do have to concern yourself with the cross U term that was present in the overall description of the displacement field. And so what I'm going to go on to the next one, right, is that basically what is used as a rule of thumb is that generally if you have G dot B less than or equal to a third, you won't see the dislocation and then it's considered invisible, all right? But the problem is you actually have to go through and look at the cross U term as well and see what that gives you. So if you have G dot B equals zero and G dot B cross U equals zero, then the dislocation's invisible. You've got everything oriented just right so that you don't see its strain field. There's another rule of thumb that says if G dot B equals zero and G dot B cross U is less than or equal to about 0.6-ish, then you will also not see the dislocation. All right, and so these are just some things that you can go through and look at in your particularities of G and B and U for your system. Again, we could spend many lectures looking at just these details, and what I want to do instead is give you an overview of how this works. Okay? If you are ever doing this, it is done in detail in the Williams and Carter book, in the J.W. Eddington book you should find in a library. That's a great source for this. And then the Howie, Whelan, Nicholson, Phelps, and Pashley, or in some order of the names, is the other one that has this with chapters and chapters of this, okay? Because at the time those two books were written, that's what the TEM did. It took dislocation images and analyzed Burgers vectors. And so there's lots of information that you can work your way through in that. But just conceptually, this is the idea, right? You have a displacement field altering the way that your images are formed, and they depend on G and B. Okay. The other thing is that I'm going to go through and show this maybe by going to the second to last slide, just because it's one that I'm pretty intimately familiar with. In other words, this is from my dissertation. All right, so I've done a lot of this, and I just want to give you a sense as to how much this matters. Let's go back and look maybe at this one here that says surface effects and interfaces. This is a single image of a bunch of dislocations at the interface between silicon germanium and silicon. Okay, so these things are all lying along 110 type directions, 1 1 bar 0, 1 1 0. They have particular Burgers vectors that are A over 2, 1 1 0 type. Okay, and this is an image you might see in dark field. Just to show you how much this can vary, here's a number of different two beam conditions shown of the same area of the sample with different variations in S. And you can see that the contrast coming from the same array of dislocations can be dramatically different depending on whether you're using 400, 040, 311, or 131 bar. And again, all of these things have a strong sensitivity on S as well. And so I just am trying to give you a sense that there's a lot of details in how these things give you the images that you see. Okay? Is there any question about the general idea of G dot B equals zero, G dot B cross U equals zero, and what it's doing? John?
Related to the D space.
Right? Yeah?
In the dislocation, since there's a relative displacement of the atoms, doesn't the D space change slightly, or does it vary?
So G is related to the d-spacing by 1 over, right? It's equal to g, the length of the vector g is equal to 1 over the d-spacing, right? And you've asked, well, if you have a dislocation core, your d-spacings are going to be locally different. Absolutely true, okay? A way to think about this, I think what you're asking is why does this work if g has a value that's different local to the core? Is that what you're asking? Yeah. my answer to that would be, really what it is that as you look with a particular G, you are choosing a particular orientation and looking at a specific set of HKL planes that are oriented with respect to your beam. Okay? Okay. And if you look at some set of HKLs, the displacement field will have some effect on that despacing, or it will not, depending on which planes you're thinking about. Okay? And so that is really the core of what G dot B cross U is saying. It's saying that if I have one set of HKL planes, either they do see some expansion or contraction from the presence of this nearby dislocation, or they don't. If they do see that expansion or contraction, then we would expect that there's a difference between the zero and the G intensities along that G. So all that G dot B or G dot B cross U captures is in that question. You can even think about the cross U term as being a way of capturing not only the distortions caused laterally in HKL, but also shear type distortions there too. Okay, and that's something that's, you know, we'd have to go through the elasticity theory a bit, but really the U is kind of capturing if I have a Burgers vector in some direction and a U in another direction, the B cross U captures kind of the out-of-plane expansions of a given set of planes to first order. And that's why it can be necessary to look at that also. Another way of thinking, there's lots of ways of thinking about this. Another way of thinking about this is that your HKLs are essentially a strain gauge in your material. If you have perfect material, the HKLs are unstrained. Okay? In the use of a strain gauge on a big chunk of metal, what you're doing is you're looking at, does anyone know what a strain gauge is and how they work? Everyone? Anyone? Give me a hand raise. I mean, I want to use this analogy only if it makes sense. Okay, a couple of you. I don't know, I took a class on experimental mechanics once because I used to be a mechanical engineer. The way a strain gauge works is you take a little wire and you make lots of wire passes and you stick it on top of a sample and then you drop a current through that, right? And if you strain it, then you're going to increase a little bit the length of that wire and then the resistance is going to change. You put that in a Wheatstone bridge circuit and you measure that resistance change and you correlate that with the strain, okay? That's the way a strain gauge works. Okay, here, HKLs have a given distance between them that's the core lattice spacing for an unstrained crystal. If you strain the crystal, they change. Now, instead of using a resistance change in a wire, what you're using is you're using electrons, right, that diffract from HKLs, and you're seeing how the diffraction changes as the HKL spacing changes. Okay? And so again, you do this in your image, kind of pixel by pixel, and if the HKL hasn't changed, the difference between zero and G intensities won't change. But as you get closer, the HKLs change a bit from that dislocation core, and so with a fixed electron wave in, you're going to get a difference in the relative diffraction to a given angle. Okay? You know, I mean, there's all, you can go through and draw this from the Awaldt sphere construction almost, right? If you take and you have zero and you have G and you're in a strong two-beam condition, then you have set up, here's K sub I, right? Here's K sub D, there's my Awaldt sphere. If I'm in a two-beam condition with this exactly at S equals zero, right, then my Awaldt sphere goes straight through here, all right? If instead I have S a little bit greater than zero, right, greater than zero, it's a little bit above, okay? So what happens is that local to the dislocation core, because of the small differences in the HKL spacings, you get different answers to this, right? And so if you're far away, let's say you've set up the overall system so that S equals zero for the perfect single crystal, right? Then you're going to get the A-volt sphere intersecting here and exactly at the reciprocal lattice point. But as you get closer to the dislocation, there's going to be a slight difference in the d-spacing, okay? So it's equivalent to thinking that you've got a bit of a deviation away from the exact Bragg condition. In this case, it's not so much a tilt that you've put on the crystal, it's a tilt within the crystal, right, that changes where the A-volt sphere is going to intersect locally, okay? And so that means you actually have two separate answers to the diffraction that come out, right? There's going to be the perfect area, and then as you get local, you're going to have different A-volt sphere cuts and different intensities resulting in diffraction space, okay? And so again, if you put an aperture around zero, right, then you would find that you would have different intensities in the different regions because of the different diffraction that's occurring along that column through the thickness that forms the intensity on the pixel, okay? Lots of different ways of thinking about it, okay? And again, the G dot B cross U stuff is telling you what the difference in the HKL planes is going to be from the presence of that particular geometry of that particular dislocation, all right? And if G dot B cross U equals zero, then that set of planes doesn't feel any strain. And that's just a result of that isotropic elasticity calculation, right? And if G dot B equals zero and there's no edge component, same thing. You don't see that dislocation because nothing's changed locally in the diffraction condition. But if G dot B equals some number, then you do see a diffraction change, and that expresses itself in the image as some intensity, okay? And so it's just all about the particularities of that, okay? Lots of, you know, different ways of putting your head around this. That actually brings me to one other thing, too, is that if you look, the S term is one that is also pretty important, right? Because as we look back at the Howey-Wheeland equations, right, the new term was Sz plus G dot dr dz. And so you should expect if you mechanically tilt the sample a bit and change S, that will again change everything, right? It'll change all of these interrelationships because you've changed the diffraction condition a bit, right? So if you go away and you say, in my perfect crystal, instead of having S equals zero, I now set up a condition where S is greater than zero. So this is my new diffraction condition with S greater than zero. Then the same thing, right? Local to the core, right? You're going to have a different A-volt sphere construction because of a slight difference in the nature of the HKL planes. And so that should tell you that the deviation parameter is a very important one as well in forming the images that you see, okay? So again, returning to this last couple of slides, right, that I showed from my own stuff, this is, again, a single HKL, the 400 condition, all right? And look, this is with S very much greater than zero. You can see that you can barely see G. Here, S is just a little bit greater than zero. You can see the Kikuchi line a little bit to the outside of the G. Here is S equal to zero, S less than zero, S very much less than zero. Look at these images, right? Very, very different in their contrast. I mean, they're strikingly different in their contrast. And all I've done is tilt my sample some very small number of milliradians, right? But the images I see are a whole lot different because in the top case, you know, away here, away from the dislocation, I have a given gray level that's determined by the diffraction condition. And then local to the dislocation, we have a different diffraction condition occurring, continuously varying towards the core, and this shows up as a white line on a black background in this case. And again, it's very strongly dependent. And, you know, if we look, we can almost see that, you know, if this angle here is, oh, I don't know, what would the angle be at 400 and silicon, 200 kV? Yeah, it's something on the order of tens of milliradians. These are very small number of milliradian changes of the orientation, giving very large differences in the contrast you see in the microscope, right? And again, all of that, you know, is true throughout all the different imaging conditions. Here's for 311, different S's, And again, look at that image versus this image, right? The one that's S very much greater than 0 on the 311 versus S very much less than 0 on the 311. Would you even expect those things to have anything in common? Right? Just looking at them, they look very, very different. Right? There's hardly anything similar in these intensities between this image and that one. But all it is just a very small difference in how we've oriented this. Okay? So you can use these effects as ways to analyze dislocations as well. And this was just one example where I went through, and here's a G.B table, right? So here's all the Burgers vector possibilities for silicon germanium on silicon. Here's the G I used, and it looks like it's great, right? There's lots of zeros. So I would expect that in 400, if I had an A over 2011 dislocation, the thing would be gone. But the problem that I had is as you go through all these Gs, those same dislocations are apparent in every single image. It doesn't work. Okay, why doesn't it work? It doesn't work because it's actually G.B cross U. And here's the answers for all the G.B cross U's, and whoops, there's no zeros there at all. All right? And that's because in this system with that orientation, the out-of-plane distortions that the cross U term give cause there to be strain seen in every angle you look at it. Okay? And so it's simple if it's aluminum, isotropic, easy, right? But it gets complicated from there. And so, you know, the hope I have is that this gives you a sense as to how this all works, but you can see that there's lots of detail in getting it right for a given situation. Okay? You know, this is a real study. This is something, you know, I published out of my dissertation. And how long did it take me to figure this out? About 3 months, right? Because I was new at the time at this, right? I mean, I think now I could probably figure it out in a couple weeks, maybe a week. But, you know, it's just the sort of thing you have to go through and work through for a given situation. Okay. So that's the idea. And we'll just go through next time and do a couple more details on that and be done. Okay? Okay, so what we had been discussing when we finished the last lecture was, again, some of the details of G.B, G.B cross U, G.B times S, for example. The overarching point with all of this is that when you are dealing with dislocations, you're trying to characterize their crystallography, their Burgers vector, their slip plane, their direction, right? You image the direction. When you image the dislocation, you see which way it's lying, and you can correlate that with a particular direction through your diffraction pattern and the orientation of your diffraction pattern with your image. The thing that you want to discover is B, the slip direction. And again, all sorts of ways of thinking about that, like we talked about last time, but mostly it's trying to see the strain field associated with the dislocation, trying to understand under which orientations of imaging do you see that strain field clearly, and under which orientations do you not. And what you do is you create, in simplest form, one of these truth tables of G.B equals zero. And if you have an isotropic material, that works pretty well usually. And if you see that G.B equals zero, then what you know is you know that you have nothing visible, right? You're looking at the strain field in just the right way that it doesn't perturb the diffraction from that particular set of planes described by that particular G. And so you don't see any changes as you look at that area. If instead you're oriented in a G such that G.B does not equal zero, what happens is that local to the dislocation, the strain field is visible, and it's visible because of the way it perturbs the HKL planes associated with that G. Okay? So the G.B equals zero condition, if all goes well, is what works. Now, as we said, it's often more complicated. The full description of a strain field for a non-screw dislocation, you have to also consider the B cross U term first, right? And again, this is just to remember, right, when you're doing G.B cross U, you do the B cross U first, dot product that with the G. That's the right vectorial way of doing things. Not something you remember off the top of your head usually. And then what that gives you is another kind of truth table, right? And again, if G.B cross U equals zero, then you really know that you're not going to see anything. But generally, if you have G.B cross U less than something like 0.5, then you hope you don't see much of anything. And it starts to get to be an interpretation thing and some skill and some practice. Okay? So that's where we kind of finish that. Did anyone have any questions or thoughts as they thought about this or read about this anymore? Okay. The thing that I want to also do is really kind of finish this section off to give you some other detail type things, but things that can be important. There is a question as well about the sine of G dot B cross U. You'll note that if you have G dot B, right, equal to, say, plus 1/3, it can also equal minus 1/3, depending on which G you're using, whether you're reflecting off of one side of the planes or the other, okay? In the diffraction pattern, you'll recall for every zero, you know, so here's your zero, you have a G, then there's a minus G associated with it as well, right? And so really it's just a matter of whether you're considering the bend off of the front side of the plane or the back side. The result of that is what it tells you is that the image you see of the dislocation is going to be displaced either to one side or the other of the actual core position of the dislocation. Okay? The dislocation has a single atomic row, but its strain field has breadth, as we've talked about. And depending on which way G dot B is oriented, so that you have the plus or the minus, the dislocation image shows up on one side of the real thing or the other, depending on whether you're looking at the bend off the front side of the planes or the back side of the planes, okay? So that's just what the reason that you see the plus and minus is, that's what it's telling you, okay? That also gives you a sense that the G dot B product is going to be sensitive to the deviation parameter in a similar way, right? Because if you take HKL and you have small variations to one side or the other, right, then you're going to again find out that there's going to be a displacement associated with where the image appears versus where the actual dislocation line is, okay? And so you can also use that, the G dot B times S, as another way to kind of characterize your dislocations. It turns out that in some cases, you don't necessarily want to know what B is. You'd love to, always. But really what's important is whether or not this dislocation interacting with this dislocation is different in its Burgers vector or the same, okay? Because again, in deformation studies, that's something that you use as a way to understand interactions. And so if you go through and look at two dislocations and you look at them at different G with different S variation and they always look the same, then they must be of the same Burgers vector type. Because again, the variations of S are very sensitive in how they give you the image contrast you see, and the G dot B product times S is then one that can kind of clue you in to whether or not you're looking at the same type of dislocations all the time or not. Okay? So that's just another thing that you can use as a way to get at the information in that. And again, I showed some of these images earlier as examples of dislocation images, but I'll show them again because this is again something that makes it very clear. Here's again a full truth table of G dot B, G dot B cross U. And again, you see there's certain G dot B cross U conditions where you might expect to have images of your dislocations. And just to see this as you vary S, you'll note that some dislocations show similar contrast and some show different contrast with variations in S. And what this lets you do is intimate that certain pairs of dislocations are the same Burgers vector as you vary S. Okay? So again, it's just another way of looking at this. And so this is looking at this page that has the number of different images of the two-beam conditions on a plan-view silicon germanium sample called Surface and Interfaces, two pages here all at once. And again, you can see that as you vary between the different G dot B and the different S conditions, sometimes the dislocations change their contrast in the same way as you vary S. And if that's the case, then they must have the same Burgers vector. So that's another way of going through all this. Okay, so it's just a little bit of detail on all that, all right? Some other details on dislocation imaging that are worth knowing, I think these are, again, very short summaries of massive amounts of work done in the earlier stages of electron microscopy and are still relevant for people doing deformation studies in particular. I want to just go through a couple of specific types of dislocations you see and images that you see from them. It's not uncommon to see dislocations that are loops. In other words, the line defect collapses in upon itself. These form often during radiation experiments, right? So if you have some point defect being pushed into your material, say that the material is being used in a nuclear reactor, right, then you would have lots of point defect flux in, and those create little loops. Often, sometimes in materials that have highly ionic bonding, simply ion milling the sample to make it will cause this, okay? And that's a problem. So you're introducing lots of defects by the incident ions that are used to thin the sample. So if you see little loops like this, that may be one thing going on. If you have a sample that you held at high temperature and then you quenched it, When you're at high temperature, there's a high number of vacancies in equilibrium, and if you quench that quickly, you may again see that these vacancies agglomerate to form loops. Ion implantation into semiconductors, certainly a very important thing that's done in order to create p-n junctions. Okay, so again, ion implantation can lead to accommodations of or accumulation of point defects, both vacancies and interstitials, and these things can again collapse to form loops. When you look at dislocation loops, you can, if you want, go through and find out some details about the nature of the loops. Again, they're Burgers vectors. Some of them, when you have the collapse of interstitials or vacancies, you can form either extrinsic or intrinsic stacking faults. And again, those are some details in the crystallography of these features. But again, by going through and changing the way that you image with G.BS and looking at the Burgers vectors you have, you can go through and determine whether or not you have intrinsic or extrinsic loops. Again, all these things are of importance to metallurgical people as they do their work. Okay? And again, the details on all of these things, they're discussed somewhat within the Williams and Carter book. And if you are doing this, you can. I would strongly recommend that you go to some of the older texts like the Eddington or the Hirsch-Howey-Whelan, because these are really done in a lot more detail there, because that was much more things of the time. Now, there's another type of dislocation loop that's called a prismatic dislocation loop. And this is just an example showing how if you pick a given G, right, for a prismatic dislocation loop, the Burgers vector is the same all the way around the loop because it's the same defect all the way around, so the slip that it creates is the same in all directions. But because it's a loop, there's different regions where G dot B cross U, and in particular the B cross U term, are going to necessarily be equal to zero. And so this is one way to look at the G dot B cross U phenomena, because you can see that in particular directions there are absences of contrast, and other directions the contrast is visible. And so what that says is in that area, such as D, right, on the loop on the left, you must have G dot B cross U equal to zero, whereas if you go to A, the B cross U term is no longer equal to zero, and that's why you see the dislocation. So in fact, we also know that the Burgers vector is perpendicular to that because of the nature of the cross products and dot products we're dealing with. Okay, so if you were to go through and change the image orientation, you'd see, again, the same type of feature, but the empty region, the invisible region, would change in its orientation because you've just changed G. Okay, so again, this demonstrates pretty clearly a G dot B cross U invisibility condition. And so that's a fairly common thing to use as a way to identify these types of defects. Okay. Another type of defect is it's not uncommon for dislocations to form dipoles. Dipoles are dislocations that are, they're basically a loop that was formed and then stretched by some deformation process. And what you end up having is that there's a very, as a result of having this loop that had a Burgers vector and then you see and you stretch it out, you end up having no long-range strain field from these things because the opposite sides of this cancel their strain field, okay? The Burgers vector is the same on each side of this, and so if you look and you have a screw that's going one way versus the other, then they end up canceling their strain fields out in the long term. But you can still image them, and what you find is that in this case, the G dot B S term is the one that you use, and if you find that if you change from S being positive to negative and you see a change in the type of contrast, so that you have the image of the dislocations move either inside or outside of where the real line must be, then you know you have a dipole. Okay, so again, it's just one more example of the types of things that you can see when you look at dislocations. All right. Just to reemphasize, the goal of all of this is to characterize the overall behavior of the defects within the sample. And again, not uncommon to see things like pileups of dislocations. This is, of course, a beautiful image of it on the upper micrograph there. Complex dislocation networks. You know, that means you've got some deformation that's happened, and that's what you're interested in imaging. Cold rolled alloy, another example, just again showing that you can see lots of defects within materials using this type of microscopy. And so again, in each of these cases, what you're doing is you're looking at the interactions. You may be interested in finding the Burgers vectors, and this is the sort of thing that we're going to characterize with all of this. Okay. Now, another couple of details. If you look at screw dislocations, you'll remember that for a pure screw dislocation, it was only the G dot B term that mattered. Interestingly, if you look edge on a screw dislocation, there is a surface relaxation that's going to happen because that dislocation hits the surface, and the lack of constraint there is going to cause some of the atomic planes to bend in, and that will essentially give you a U term to cross in. And so even though the dislocations are quote-unquote invisible by a G dot B equals zero condition, you may see them, and they look like these little pinholes. And again, that's the result of having some surface relaxation, add in a cross term to all this. Okay, again, a detail, but I want you to see it so that if a later date you can go, oh yeah, I remember Stack talked about this stuff, and I should go back and look at those notes, right, as I go through and do my work. All right? Also, it's very possible that you may see things like this. And this is a case where your TEM sample had some form of oxide that formed on it, maybe during the electropolishing, or just this is a material that forms oxide readily. Maybe it's something that's part of the sample as you did the deformation, whichever. The dislocations will terminate at a free surface, but they'll also terminate at a dissimilar interface. And so that's just a property, a topological property of a dislocation. And so again, it's not uncommon to see things like this. And what that would tell you is that these things have become pinned at the interface between the oxide and your real material. And those things look kind of like misfit dislocations. It's not really quite what they are because it's an amorphous material with a crystalline material, but they look kind of like that. And that, again, that's not an uncommon thing to see. And it's just because of the topology of how these things must terminate in the sample. Interface misfit dislocations are very common things to look at in the semiconductor material area, in metal films on semiconductors. Anytime you have two materials that have dissimilar lattice parameters or even dissimilar lattices generally, you can accommodate the misfits between the substrate and the film by introducing dislocations at the interface between the two. So interfacial misfit dislocations are one that are quite common to see. And again, I've been using this example throughout. The one thing to note with interfacial misfit dislocations is that they can be very complicated to find Burgers vectors, again, because the cross U term is usually oriented in such a way that it causes you to lose these nice invisibility conditions. So it's just a caution that interfacial misfit dislocations are of a lot of interest, but if you're going to go through and start to want to work on those and look at Burgers vectors, be aware that that's not always so simple to do. And again, I've used this example a bunch of times, and I'll move on from that. The other thing that is also worth talking about in terms of diffraction contrast that's similar but not a dislocation, if instead you have a material that's a matrix and it has embedded within it a second material that is coherent, does everyone know what coherent means by that? Does anyone know what coherent means? Okay. If you have one phase and bounding with another phase and there are no misfit dislocations at all, then that is a coherent interface. If instead you have dislocations at that interface, that is an incoherent interface, okay? Or semi-coherent if the dislocation number is small. Okay, incoherent means that there's either lots and lots of dislocations or no registry at all, okay? So if you have a coherent interface, that means you have no dislocations present between the two. And this again shows a very strong characteristic contrast. This is called Ashby-Brown contrast after the two fellows that kind of first figured this out. And in this case, you will again see a line of no contrast, very similar to our prismatic loop. And if you vary the G, the line of no contrast is always perpendicular to the G. And that's again an indication that you have this as the operative thing going on, a coherent precipitate. I had the pleasure of seeing this fellow Mick Brown give a talk this past October. He won the Distinguished Lecturer Award for the electron microscopy meeting that was held, and it was interesting to hear his talk because he had been a participant in most of the early stage stuff on this, and it was just interesting to kind of hear someone talk about how this was, you know, quite a realization and a discovery and a great, you know, observation in diffraction contrast and kind of just understand how that all comes about. Because now this is just something that's, again, very standard. This is just called Ashby-Brown contrast. And if you go through and you look at some feature and you see the contrast from it, and if you vary G and you see this line in absence, then you know you have something like a coherent precipitate involved. Okay? So it's just kind of interesting to see these sorts of things. Again, an overview. Each of these things we could spend much more time on, but we're going to go ahead and move beyond a bit so we can talk about high-resolution imaging. So hopefully, if at a later point you're doing this sort of work, you'll remember the overarching idea, which is that if you have a continuous variation in the strain field, the way that you think about it is you use this modified form of the Howey-Wheelan equations where you consider G dot with the discontinuous strain field, and you'd use that as a way to understand whether or not you see something. And really, as John Kappas mentioned the other day, it's really that you're not imaging the dislocation, it's that you're imaging the strain field, right? And how do you see the strain field? So that's kind of the overarching comment on it all. So hopefully that's, at some point will be useful. You'll certainly see these things in the literature. Diffraction contrast is used in the literature quite a bit still, even in nano stuff. And so it's worth knowing how this all works. I would also like to pontificate for a moment and say that the amount of information that you can get from doing proper diffraction contrast microscopy is very, very large. Okay, I think that maybe I've shown at least some sense of that there's lots of things that you can learn by doing bright field and dark field imaging. There is a recent tendency, in my opinion, to immediately try to do things with high resolution microscopy. It's pretty, it's sexy, it looks great. Certain journals really love to see that high resolution image, and I'll leave them nameless. But please, when you're thinking about your work, if you're thinking about defects, if you're thinking about interfaces, remember that you should start off by looking at this in diffraction contrast mode and trying to extract as much information as you can out of it, because it's actually very, very powerful and pretty straightforward when you get a chance to do it. Again, to pontificate, the number of times that I've reviewed articles where people show me a high-resolution image that's from a very small area saying that they've created defect-free nano-somethings, usually it's the nano-wire crowd, they show a very small region and say, here's a high-resolution region, right? And this is single crystalline defect-free, right? I almost routinely reject those because all that tells me is that a very small region of the sample is single crystal and high-resolution, and defect-free. And so when you are characterizing your materials, a more compelling description of that is one that uses diffraction contrast to show a number of samples, right, over a large area in an appropriate G.B condition, or several, right? And then that indicates more correctly that you have no defects present in your sample because you're sampling a much larger area. If instead you are going to show a high-resolution image to indicate that, go through and do the diffraction contrast anyway and state it, right? Shown in figure 3 is a high-resolution image of this indium phosphide nanowire. We've also done diffraction contrast using appropriate G.B conditions to show that the defects are not present over large numbers of samples, right? Because then if you get some pain in the ass reviewer like me, I'll be fine with that, okay? Because it's really the right way to do things, is to give you a large area of view and not just focus on the high resolution, all right? And again, every time you open certain journals, there's just always the one high-resolution shot, and it drives me personally crazy.